Welcome to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I am Mark Hoffmeyer, and joining me is a man who learned to play the guitar after watching Ricky and the Flash, and he currently has a number one hit in Manitoba. It's John Levingood.
Well, and every now and then I play that song when I'm trying to coerce a ghost out of hiding in a haunted house.
Like in Conjuring?
Like in Conjuring too, yeah.
So after watching Meryl Streep and her daughter, you know, play rock stars in Ricky and the Flash, what influenced you to finally pick up a guitar, John Levingood?
I mean, I didn't even see a trailer for this movie, so I don't know what this movie is.
Dude, you don't have to play tough, man. You watched it. You sent me a text message. You said, hey, I watched this movie, Mark. I just bought the movie poster, and I bought the album for it because Ricky and the Flash's music, so good.
And when I sent you the text, you could see the text on the screen smeared from my tear on my phone as I was typing it.
You were so – this movie hit you hard. And then I didn't hear from you for – because we weren't podcasting yet. I didn't hear from you for about 8 months, like nothing on the site, nothing. And then all of a sudden, you're like, Mark, you call me up. And then just you sing an eight-minute song over speaker.
That's like a Meatloaf song.
I mean, like it was like Fog Hat – Slow Ride meets I Would Do Anything for Love.
You think that our young listeners have no idea about any of the things that we're referencing right now?
Doesn't matter.
Meatloaf and Fog Hat and Meryl Streep.
Look up Jim Carrey Fog Hat, and that's all you need to know. And then look up Meatloaf Fight Club. That's pretty good. And then Meryl Streep. People know who Meryl Streep is. But so you were just touring around Canada. Tell me about that.
It's awfully cold this time of year. I'm sure I would have hated that, despite my plus-sizedness making me marginally resilient to the cold.
You sold out a bar of, you know, I mean, 40 capacity, but you sold it out. Like, how was it?
40 capacity, but there were three people there, and I was one, and the bartender was one, and the cocktail waitress was one.
I mean, they had a pretty good show, though, right?
Yeah, I mean, the three of us loved.
So you love performing your own music?
I guess so. It's like Coyote Ugly. I'm just trying to live my dream here.
Wait, oh, you're Don't Fight the Moonlight?
That's right.
You were Leanne Rimes in it?
My Piper Parabooing.
That was an interesting intro. Hey, you did good with You did pretty good with improv there, though, John. You didn't fall apart.
Last of Bath would be improv. I get Last of Bath so you can see my developed skills in it.
Yeah, I mean, normally you just would have flop slided. Like, you just would have become like all liquid. You'd have been like,
it happens.
You'd have been like T-1000. I just
my bones melt and I start to get shaped like Jabba the Hutt.
Like, I'm seeing you in a chair right now and you just drop.
Yeah.
Wait, that was Salacious Chroma. Oh,
it was up to the, it's gripping the ceiling. That was like our episode 2 or 4 when we first started talking about Salacious Crumb. I feel like we talked about that little critter for many episodes in our first couple dozen episodes, and then like he kind of just disappeared in our memories.
We got to keep it fresh. We don't want to force Salacious Crumb.
That's right.
All right, so in the words of John Lazavath, I think we have some listener questions.
Yeah. Our first question comes from Charlie B. Murphy from Twitter. That's at Charlie E-Y B. Murphy, no E. And Charlie B. Murphy asks, what's the ideal number of deaths in office horror? And I want to add that Charlie put office horror as a hashtag, which actually changed my thought process in answering the question.
So for me, just the way I'm looking at this question, two people need to walk out of the building.
Two.
So if there's eight people, then it just has to be six, right?
You mean in the beginning they walk out alive or they're the last survivors?
Last survivors. So it always
– really?
So it's like 80 people, 78 need to die.
Okay.
You know, 14 people, 12 people need to die.
Okay.
Or you could leave it ambiguous, like in The Descent, where she stabs Juno in the leg, and then she runs out, and you're like, hey, what happened?
So it's like, my first inclination was to view this as like a movie where a bunch of people die, like a slasher movie. It's like, I don't know, anywhere from 8 to 20 people will die, yeah. Right? Just like I think of it as a Jason movie. It could be 8, could be 20, maybe 5. And then like the lower the number is, obviously the more attention that the feature death scenes characters get before they are stalked down and killed, or maybe the kills are more drawn out and gruesome, right? But then I thought, like, hashtag office horror. Are we making office horror a subgenre?
I think it's a niche right now going on, right?
It's a quasi-genre.
Yeah, quasi-genre.
It is a genre overtone.
Like, there was P2, but that was an office building's parking structure.
Right, so that was actually kind of where I started thinking.
And only one person walked out of that. But I'd have liked it if both of them walked out.
In a movie like that, though, you can have only, like, 3 to 5 people die. It's because usually there's, like, the target, the point of fixation of the killer. And everyone else just happens to become obstacles
for a pizza delivery guy.
A pizza delivery guy, that sounds kind of funny, the haphazardness of that. Hey, I'm sorry, they forgot the extra pepper. But, like, so...
Wait. Gathers. The killer goes, here's the tip.
Stab. Hashtag horror dad joke. But so it strikes me that, like, I mean, this could be like any slasher movie where the number of kills is inversely proportional to the amount of average time that each victim gets. So, okay. And if it's office horror, it actually makes me feel like there should be more attention on the victims to bring out that office culture, the office sociology, the little ecosystem that is that office, the people who chat at the, you know, the water thing or the coffee room. Like, you know, I don't know. I feel like those little dynamics get targeted. So maybe you have, I don't know. I feel like that alters your victims. It can't just be a flat out slasher where 8 random kids who are doing drugs die or 8 random accountants die. If you're calling it hashtag office horror, does that make sense?
I just think 2 people need to walk out. And one of them's limping.
That's interesting, because in one of our movies that we're going to discuss, only one person walks out.
Yeah. Oh, spoilers. Spoilers.
the whole podcast is a spoiler.
Spoilers.
After we finish the list of questions, it's all spoilers,
and
folks.
And the movies are in the title, so yeah, spoilers.
Right. So you know that we're going to spoil Ma'am and Belko.
Done. I would have liked Belko if 2 people walked out.
So can I actually take this listener question?
Because that's bucking the trend. Because they're like, only one person can walk out. And they're like, no. 2 of us are walking out. And then they're like, yo, it's going to only be 1. They're like, no, we're doing 2. And then 2 come out. And then they crush people and they're like, yeah, we're victorious. Like, they defeated the man. You know what I mean?
So I'm just curious, though, with the hashtag office horror, what movies, other than the movies that we're discussing today, come to mind when you think of office horror? Because for me, it's so – and I don't mean just a horror movie that happens to take place in an office. I mean something that brings the dynamic of the office somehow into the movie. That's how I think of it. And I don't really think of anything – I didn't research this. But nothing really came to mind other than the 2 movies that we are discussing today.
Yeah, I mean, I would have researched that horror.
Well, I mean, I'm sure there are some. It's just like I really can't come up with them, you know? And I have a feeling that most of the things that we could come up with are going to be more almost crime murder thrillers than slasher horror.
Like Die Hard.
Like The Temp. You know what I mean? Like The Temp. Like she's flat out killing people left and right, but it's just, I don't know. It never felt even horror adjacent to me, even though it's very, mean.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I feel like this could become something that is emulated. These 2 movies that came out sort of close together. Like I can't help but to think that over the next few years, we're going to start seeing more office horror come out as people are influenced by these 2 films.
I don't know. I guess there could be influence, but they didn't really do too well. Oh, Compliance. Oh, that one. Oh, Suspiria. Aliens in a Workplace? Wreck? No. Sorry, I'm going out. Like, oh, she's working House of the Devil. No, I think you're right. There's people who are killed while working.
I'm sure there are a few. They're probably more obscure, or maybe we're just not thinking of it, you know? But I just thought that was... That could be an interesting thing to explore in the future, because even when I was thinking of my answers to this, you know, we spend a lot of time, folks, thinking about our discussions, and it gives us a lot of time for movies to pop in our head that are similar to or that remind us of. It didn't happen for me with these 2. They just remind me, you know, a little bit of each other.
So what's your answer?
I don't. Well, to my own question that was my tangent. I don't know. I think that these 2 are going to be, even if there were others, I think these 2 will be the seminal founders of the office horror subgenre, should it happen.
I have a question for you. You ready?
Oh, I'm braced.
All right, 80 people.
I clenched my butt.
Oh goodness, 80 people in an office, right?
Okay.
At the end of the movie, 4 people walk out. Stupid.
It sort of sounds like too many. You know, that sounds more like if they do that.
Because that's where the tension gets good, is when the 4 people start killing each other.
If 4 people come out alive, I feel like so that the movie isn't too dividing our attention to following a lot of individual people's trajectories in the movie. I feel like there has to be a lot of paired up or teamwork or crossing over. And when 4 people survive, it almost strikes me that they're teaming up against most everyone else. And then it has the zombie movie dynamic, which is fine. But that's the model that I see that adopting to make that work. It's like them versus the crazy mob.
Oh, so like
I don't know if I'm right. That's just what came to mind. It's just
but I just if everyone's turning on each other and it's Lord of the Flies, I just want 2 people. That's it. I don't want 4. You don't need to add Charles and Deborah.
If there's 2, though, at least one of them has to be the one that you absolutely would not have expected.
Yeah. Or one person just hides the whole time and it actually
works. Like the little old lady who was physically the least adept.
Yeah, she fell asleep somewhere.
Right, yeah. Something like that. And in the beginning, everyone just assumed that they got her because they saw her legs sticking out from behind a desk. And there were all this killing going on in the room. And it's just that no one noticed her and she was asleep and she has bad hearing.
Yeah, and then she walks out at the end.
Right, yeah. I think that would be... That would be like a fun, and they could be referencing almost like mean jokes about why she died first. And then like all those people making those jokes die. And then it turns out that she survived it. Oh God, where's our assistant producer? If anyone's listening, is anyone listening? We are assistant producers on so many future movies in the next decade.
Yep. Give us those credits.
Give us the credits.
I mean, there's a lot of good stuff to be mined in these, like Die Hard, The Raid, Dread. Which is pretty much The Raid, but it's still different.
Right.
Once you're locked in a place, I think that's a very good, ripe area to have a horror film. And it keeps the budget down.
Sure, absolutely. A lot of movies sort of do that. I don't know if they revolve around that, you know, like or at least they have set piece scenes built around it, like in Resident Evil crap. I think it was like part 6.
Wait, Resident Evil crap? Is that like the...
No, like it was my crap pause. Like Resident Evil 6, I think, had them in the skyscraper.
Yeah.
And they were at the top of it and the zombies were like just totally enveloping it. It was almost like they had siege engine war machines coming forward.
Yeah, and they were jumping off the roof, right?
Yeah, big flying dragon shit. Yeah, like it. So, I mean, but that, I feel like that was a 20-minute scene. Like, it was a big thing. And so a lot of movies adopt that. I don't know that a lot of movies revolve around it. Would you consider Night of the Living Dead to have that model?
Yeah.
Okay. Like, because, you know, like...
It's like a most siege trapped... thriller.
Hashtag siege thrillers.
I think Assault on Precinct 13 started that.
Oh, like, yeah.
The term came up. It was around before that, but... Siege, that's been around for a while. I wish I could take a credit for that, but I can't. Well, no, wait, no, that's not an office building, Assault on Precinct 13. That's like in a precinct.
With offices.
Yeah. but it's not an office building. Jeez, we're going down a rabbit hole here, man.
So thank you, Charlie B. Murphy, for your question. We hope that you are thoroughly confused by our answers to 5 questions that you didn't ask and perhaps an answer to the question you did.
I got to be honest, Love and Good, you confuse me. So I think that's a credit to this. I just kept saying 2. 2 people.
Like, it's like the first time in high school math when you're introduced to the value of I. No, it can't exist.
Wait, what do you mean? What do you mean and sometimes why? Wait, when? All right, so we got that question done. Let's jump into the meat and potatoes of this podcast, yeah? Let's jump into the bacon and eggs. Let's jump into the cheddar and sausage.
Cool. First movie. We're going to be discussing Mayhem, the more recent of the 2 releases.
You didn't catch what I was doing. I was trying to make you hungry.
I was trying to make me hungry?
I was going to keep going. I was like, I was going to the yogurt and granola.
To our regular listeners who have heard me being heckled when I was absent, and it was Mark and John Lazabeth, I believe they stipulate that I'm always hungry. So joke's on you, Mark. I already was.
I just made myself hungry.
I'm always hungry.
You're like the Hulk. The hungry Hulk.
Dude, that guy, when he hits like a McDonald's value menu, does he just order like, I'll have 500 McChickens and 500 McDoubles.
I don't think he would order. I just think he would walk in. I think he wouldn't order.
I mean, not enough of those things are already made. He's just going to the freezer and eating all the raw patties.
That's right. And then when he turns back into Ruffalo, Ruffalo's like, oh my God.
Then he has a food hangover.
That's right.
That would be awful.
That's all right. So the first movie tonight is Mayhem, directed by Joe Lynch. The guy who also directed Wrong Turn 2, Knights of Badassdom. He is a guy who can work wonders with very tiny budgets. He's known for his gore, even though Knights of Badassdom doesn't really have all that. But yeah, he's just an indie filmmaker, very much so a genre filmmaker, and he made a film called Mayhem. Since I butchered Insidious last week, do you want to break out explain Mayhem? I can't even ask you to explain a movie.
So, all right, I'll take a shot at this. A corporate office building, a law firm, has some of its occupants exposed to a rage-like, morally degenerating virus that spreads through the office complex, inducing a legal quarantine for 8 hours to outwait the incubation period of the virus, during which the white-collar workers act out their worst impulses on each other and carry out vengeance, personal gain, whatever they can, because it's almost like the Purge, where the legal ramifications are lifted. It's almost like you're temporarily insane. I think that was a very convoluted way of describing it.
Now you did it. So the virus is called ID7, also called the red eye virus.
Because you get one red eye.
No, because the person who invented it loved the Wes Craven film Red Eye.
Did you notice that while just about everyone infected had one red eye, no one had two? And it wasn't the same red eye?
You know how much that would cost in CGI? That was Joe Lynch's major...
That was them cutting the budget in half?
No, I'm serious. He said the worst thing about this film was doing all the eyes and for the CGI shots. He said there was like 1,000 shots.
So that's red why everyone only had one eye.
Yep.
It was red. That is... That's very creative.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it would have cost him... It would have been there's no exact numbers for this budget, but they shot it in 25 days in Siberia. So
for the listeners who are listening, despite the spoilers, and you haven't seen the movie, just in case you want to pull the plug, I'll try and help you decide if you want to see this. This reminds me of The Purge a little bit. 28 Days Later, just in flavor. Belko, just in, I'll call it vague model. The fact that we have people trapped in a building that end up killing themselves, each other for one reason or another, and it's a little office cultured. And I've got one more movie that this actually reminded me of a lot, and I'm pretty proud of what I thought was a clever observation.
Mayhem?
No, not Mayhem. We're talking about Mayhem.
Yeah, but you're saying Belko reminded you of something.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm insane.
You're losing me tonight, man.
I'm insane. No, I'm insane. Hey, wait, but this reminded me of 28 Days Later, The Purge, and Belko.
Gotcha. I have a cool question.
In execution.
Whenever we've talked about Belko, I've never heard you compare it to other movies. But when I hear you talk about Mayhem, even in your review for Mayhem, you compared it to three movies in the title.
Well, I compare Belko to two movies in my review, and I'm adding a third today.
Oh, okay, cool. So we're equaling it out.
Yeah, but I guess. Well, but one of them isn't a horror movie. It was actually just a riff on words when I said Office Space meets Battle Royale. But it reminded me a tad of Battle Royale. But the real thing that it reminds me of, I'm gonna unleash on you guys later.
Wait, can I guess? Oh, later. And then you're going to let me guess beforehand, right?
Well, I'll let you guess. I will let you guess.
All right, cool.
But sorry. So to me, this has the flavors, I'm going to say. It didn't really feel like anything was, you know, copied, if you will. But it had a lot of flavors, in my opinion, from The Purge, 28 Days Later, Belko. Would you add anything to that?
Margin call?
Margin call? Okay.
Yeah, no, because they have to work their way to the top, like through the chain of command as they're predicting that the bubble's going to burst. So they're like going Dread. Higher and higher.
Like Dread?
Yeah, and they're seeing, like, you know, a huge thing, like, you know, really bad things about to happen, and they're going their way up, like working their way up just without murder. But yeah, so they get this. So I don't know. So the you know what I liked most about this movie was Steven Hyun, his character Derek Cho. I just love that he was the lead of this movie. It felt fresh. Like, I liked it. I didn't feel he wasn't a stock character. He put a lot of personality into it. Basically, when he started with Evil Corp, that's what we're calling it. They specialize in being evil. He's this young, you know, fresh-faced kid. And then 6 months later, he's kind of a douchebag. He actually found a loophole to get some, like, when someone kills somebody with the ID7 virus, they're temporarily insane, so they can't get in trouble. So he gets a raise, he gets a corner office, and he is kind of becoming a jerk, but he's still pretty nice. But then something gets pawned on him. He gets framed for doing something that someone else did. Then he gets fired. So that's why he's trying to go to the top of the building to
murder people. They pull a Disclosure on him.
Yeah, that's right.
Like Michael Douglas in Disclosure when Demi tried to frame him.
Man, that's a pull right there.
I'm not comparing this movie to Disclosure, by the way. It's nothing like Disclosure. But no, I agree with you, by the way. I love what Steven Yeun brought to it. And remember, like, that kind of narration that he had in the beginning when you're seeing him at the different phases of his inception into the law firm, and you see him go from the nice bright-eyed bushy tail and the little office dynamic, and there were little glimpses of cattiness and office-isms, and then you saw him get cold. And when we kind of finished that intro montage, it was pretty early that he was like being, you know, a ball sack lawyer who is getting really pissy at someone about not finding his coffee cup.
Yeah, I mean, he has a right to be mad about that because his sister gave it to him, dude.
But he was really gripping. Like, this one girl's like, I don't know, I left it right.
Oh yeah, you're right.
Remember,
yeah.
Like I feel like that was them. He went from that nice, kind, lighthearted, you know, cute, cheeky introduction, and then they just showed you him being like, and it was amusing, but showed you him being a jerk, and it was like a few steps away from American Psycho. Yeah. Would you compare that at all to this?
No.
No. Is that an office horror?
Yeah, I mean,
it doesn't rely on the office. It's office horror-esque.
Yeah, there adjacent. We go. I mean, it's pretty horrible who all these people are.
I'm getting really excited with the office horror thing, by the way, listeners. I don't think this is going to go away. For the record, I have only had one quarter of a beer. This is me normal. So I'm sorry. I think I interrupted your thought process. So he introduces himself. I brought up that his first scene, he was kind of a jerk.
Yeah. And then he just kind of murders his way to the top, killing a lot of people. And then he gets his redemption.
So how did you feel? What do you think we're supposed to think about how the virus got in there? Was that just by chance that the woman who came in, lying, posing as a lawyer, trying to get her foreclosure overturned, you know, lying the whole time, happened to be the person who brought in the virus, or the person who set down the water glass had the virus, but she's the one who's most closely associated with it on screen. Are we supposed to, I mean, even if it's coincidence, is she our patient zero in this?
People are probably screaming into this right now, but from what I remember, they said something about installing something in the law firm, and that is what spread it?
No, but I mean, how the virus got in the first place.
I mean, anybody could have walked in there.
No, but then when they showed us that the water glass was infected, her water glass, they showed us.
Oh, no,
and
his,
then they showed
his was
it going
too.
Through the air vents.
Yeah, his glass was too when he drank it.
No, he walked over to her.
No, his glass was full of the gunk.
I swear, I thought he took her water glass. Maybe I'm remembering it wrong. I might be remembering it wrong. But I felt like he ended up with her water glass.
Yeah, I think he drank – no, because other people had it before him.
I remember associating with her for some reason. Not like she planted it. You know what I mean? This is my weird tangent. This is my weird quarter beer tangent. Is this beer 80% alcohol?
I watched this movie twice, and I don't know how the virus spread.
Well, I mean, yeah, you mentioned the air, how it spread was the air thing, but I think that like the patient zero, we know that it started with that water. They presented it as if it started with the water glass.
So is this a This is like an M. Night movie.
I don't know. Oh, how'd it get in there? Got in there because of the trees.
Those aliens would really hate that water.
Mark Wahlberg is out there just staring at these trees. These trees are spreading viruses. They're getting into office buildings. Steven Yeun is killing people. Again. Like he was killing people in The Walking Dead.
Leave us alone, trees. Just stop.
What happened to all the bees?
So I guess one question I want to ask you, I'll ask you a couple questions about this film.
Okay.
How do you feel about the different ways that the virus attack people? So some people become murderers. Some people want to just hook up with their girlfriend, boyfriend. Some people throw a lot of paper. There's a lot of paper being thrown in the air in this film. For me, I felt like this ID7 virus affected each person differently depending on where they were at with their kind of id and inhibitions. So I think if all these people who were infected, only one person killed another person, so before it even hit their place, then I think it just affects each person individually in different ways.
I agree with you. I think that if two people happened to be flirting in the break room when it came through the air vents and infected them, and we're assuming that it infects them very quickly, I think that that would heighten the emotions that go with that flirtation. So if they were both flirtatious, they're going to end up making out on the copy machine. If one of them was resistant and the other was flirtatious, it would probably become violent from the person who wasn't interested or something. Like, I think that if two people were in the middle of arguing about TPS reports, like in Office Space, I think that would end up in just getting stapled in the face to death. Yeah. And then you notice in the movie also, though, that a lot of people seemed totally at peace.
The nine.
Well, so the nine, now, I don't know if their sinisterness was exaggerated, but remember Stephen Ewan's buddy in the beginning where he's like, we just need to put yourself in your room and wait this thing out. And then later he's in his room just calmly, he's clearly high blood pressure, waiting things out. But he's not enraged. He's not throwing things around. He's actually like working in his office with the door closed. So some people were less heightened. Could that mean that if you were very calm, that when this strikes you, there's nothing to magnify? But then if I came over and slapped you in the face, then that will magnify your response to that.
I also think it is who you are as a person, too. Because you saw that moment when he protected that assistant. Like, he still has...
Oh, sure. Yes.
A scene where he's kind of a jerk, but he also... Another jerk he got... This is an evil lawyer place. So, like, I'm not saying all lawyers... In this certain office, there are... I'm not talking broad. I'm talking in this office.
This movie had a lot of allegorical fun pointing the evil finger at lawyers.
There we go.
Just say that.
But I'm not talking about the wider world. I'm talking about this office. There's a jerky lawyer talking to an assistant, and then Derek comes up and defuses it and gets her back. So he has humanity. So I guess that's why he was able to – he still murdered people. But maybe – I don't understand how it affected him.
Right. I will say that there are some things – I don't want to call it inconsistent. I don't want it to sound like I'm saying it was a fault of the writers. I think it was deliberate. But even though he had his motive, you know, he wanted to work his way to the top. For reasons, but like when he had the showdown with the woman and her little cadre of maniacs, yes. It was like a scene from The Warriors, yeah. Where he's like, are we going to do this easy or are we going to do it hard? So that was a calm decision, in my opinion. And then, though, when he charges them into battle with Samara and her
weaving.
Samara weaving and her drill gun.
Melanie Cross.
So when they charge in together, though, they are smiling. So when we talk about heightening our feelings or degrading our morals, they specifically seem to be joyous. You know, not that word specific, you know what I mean? They were smiling about charging in 2-on-5 or 6 with armed people, but they were smiling. It wasn't like a rage charge. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, so that was there are a lot of moments like that where if you wanted to be the jerk on Reddit, you could be like, well, actually, the virus didn't do what they said. No, I think it was very deliberate. It's like a film, you know, a filmmaking device, or I don't know if that's the right thing to call it.
Mark, I was reading a review and I found out something interesting. The person who wrote it said something interesting. They're like, if this virus would have made everyone kind of rage infested, just everyone murders each other, we never would have got the kind of cool relationship between Derek and Melanie.
Right.
So Samara's the one who tries to get her house back. She gets thrown into this room because they're quarantined. Then Derek later gets thrown in there and then they team up to fight their way to the top. They have to kill this, they have to get the, go through the Reaper, and then they have to go through the Siren, and then they get to the boss. But, I don't know, that's, I think that's kind of interesting. With those inconsistencies, you got a kind of cool core relationship.
Right. Well, and that inconsistency was what allowed them to discuss that arrangement that they were having. You know, that was very rational. They were sitting down in that like storage room, basement room, and he says, look, I need, after they fought, after they were violent with each other, and then they calmed down. He's like, look, I need to get to the top, and I'm going to, you know, get this position. And when I have the power, I promise, like, these are very deliberate, rational discussions. I promise that I will get you your house back. And then she's like, okay, I agree. And then they put themselves at significant risk for each other all the way through. So, and again, I'm not calling that inconsistency as a fault. I'm just calling it like it's a deliberate way to move the story along. Right? Does that sound?
Yeah.
Is there a filmmaking term for this? I just want to call it a filmmaking device.
I mean, you introduce a pairing of people, one who doesn't know about the company and the other one who does. So then she asks all the questions and he can explain everything to her. I mean,
yeah, we need to have some exposition.
Like, remember on the show Vikings? I love that show Vikings. In the first season, they captured a priest and they brought the priest back with them. So he's this fish out of water and he's the fresh face seeing what's going on. So all of his questions, they answer. So it's a good way to get so I think that's a good way of it. I also think it's a nice way of kind of, you know, having a duo work together. It's almost like a buddy massacre movie.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting too. It's like I pointed out that whatever device. And I thought that sometimes when I write a review, I go share it around social media and Twitter, et cetera. And quite a lot of people tend to chime in. And, you know, I was surprised that when I asked what people thought about it, or I was just, you know, trying to prompt people into interest, like, yo, Mayhem or Belko, or what'd you think of Mayhem? And when people chime in, I didn't hear any specifically negative things. The most I thought that, you know, we'd get, you know, super critics saying, well, the virus was this, that, and the other. Instead, the most negative thing that I heard, or read, I should say, was basically to the tune of, yeah, you know, it was a perfectly enjoyable movie, but it didn't strike me as anything special. Like, that was the meanest thing I heard. And everyone else was pretty positive. No one seemed to not enjoy watching it, even if they never want to watch it again. Like, I kind of felt like that. I feel like this movie is getting a rather undivisive social media vibe. And I feel like that's not very common for a minor release. Like, even Raw has people on, oh, I thought it was boring, I hated it. Oh, I thought it was like the best, you know, artwork, anything. It was this obscure analogy for a world. Like, people were totally on other ends of the spectrum. I think, for this, it seems very calm and friendly and amicable.
People wanted more. I read a few people say that they wanted more gore. So there's a lot of violence, but there's not a lot of gore. And I was actually fine with that. Because just on two things, gore is very expensive and it takes a lot of time and he didn't have. So if he would have shot this movie in the States, he only could have paid for maybe, he said one company told him 9 days and another one told him 15. So he had to go, you know, to another continent and they gave him 25 on the dime to shoot.
You know what else? I like that this didn't, like, this was, I'm going to say this is very, very violent. I think nowadays people are used to very violent. Also meaning brutal, but no, this was very, very violent. And this was, in my opinion, hardly brutal by today's standards, right? And then Belko, which we'll discuss later, was very violent, but just mean, right? So, but if he were to have done more brutality, it would have brought more direct comparison to a movie that had come out recently before it. And no matter what the reason was for the similarity, I think that that would have worked against the movie. I think that people would have thought it was trying to be something else. And instead, it is something else, which I think is good. And it was cheekier.
I mean, there is a scene. So they team up. Derek and Melanie team up. They defeat this guy called the Reaper, who is the HR guy. They go up another floor, and then they battle the Siren and her gang of oddly face painted
in a Warriors like showdown.
Yeah, in a cubicle area. And actually, what's kind of cool is Melanie takes off her high heels. So I thought that was like very un Jurassic World of her. I thought that was
right,
cool.
Right. And unlike Bryce Dallas Howard sprinting. Yeah.
And I really bought Steven wiping those people out, but I don't know what this says about me, but my favorite shot of the movie is a scene where Melanie has another, one of the combatants, one of the warriors on the ground, and she is just whapping her with a hammer. But you don't see the woman. You just see her like you don't see anybody getting hit. You just see probably eight solid, like the way she was doing it was like, I was like, hey, this is really violent, but they aren't showing any, but it was a cool looking shot though. But it was,
if you moved that camera 6 inches, it would have turned into gratuitous brutality.
It's one of those shots. The first time I watched it, in my head, I was like, man, she like, that was brutal. Like in my head, I almost remembered her being able to see the hammer hit. But then the second time I'm like, oh, I just built it up in my head. I mean, part of that's budget too. Sure. But no, I thought that fight was pretty cool. Cool, man. And I do think though, before they go into the battle, Derek and Melanie are asking each other like, "Hey, what are your top live bands?" And that is from Green Room. Now I know this script for Mayhem has been around for a very long time. When Joe Lynch was working in an office building, he was doing a 9-to-5, and that's when he first heard about the script. So it's been around for a while, but they ripped off my movie Green Room with like favorite bands. But there is a good monologue about Dave Matthews, which is kind of cool. But then it just leads into a pretty solid action scene for what it's worth. Yeah.
I enjoyed them. Yeah. I thought it was appropriately dynamic or exciting, if you will. Right. Like, I like those smiles when they run into battle. They keep the tone, again, less mean, even though it's very violent. It was more like, this was the breezy, very violent movie.
Yeah. And you know what's interesting is Joe Lynch was talking about the actors, and he said Steven's very proactive and Samara's very reactive. So he really pushed a lot of the dialogue and she was great at reacting to it. And he said that's a compliment to both of them. So I think they kind of worked well together. They weren't two reactive actors together. I don't know. I think the main thing I took out of this movie, it was just nice to watch two relatively fresh faces engage in carnage. It just felt refreshing to me.
I agree. I bought this blind on your suggestion. Well, you didn't suggest I buy it, but you suggested we discuss it. And I just thought, well, whatever, I'm going to buy it. And for a blind buy, you know, I'm pretty pleased with myself.
I have a question in horror movies, right? I guess it doesn't work with The Conjuring because we know who the actors are. But watching Raw, I had no idea who that actress was.
Right.
And watching Descent, I had no idea who those actresses were. Do you think horror movies work better when you don't know the cast than when you do know the cast?
I think so.
Does knowing a cast make the movie – I mean, I knew who Neve Campbell was. I knew who Drew Barrymore – in Scream I'm talking about now. But I wasn't familiar with, you know, Matthew Lillard, Rose McGowan. A lot of those weren't – I don't know why I went to Scream. But I wonder if it – a lot of those kids I hadn't seen before. So I don't know. I wonder if horror is best or I don't know if this is a horror movie, but I wonder if these films are best when you don't know who the actors are.
If I'm speaking in super non-specific generalities, and I'm not talking about any particular horror movie, right? As a blanket statement, I'm going to say that I think that the general consensus is that the filmmaking quality, whatever, the acting, the writing, all these things tend to be on average lower in the horror genre. I think that budgets tend to, on average, be lower in the horror genre, despite all the effects.
Yeah.
So when you put an actor that you know in it, you create a positive expectation in a genre that is known for having for tempering one's expectations. And so it gives you an opportunity to be disappointed, I feel. Whereas when you don't know them, and they do a good job, it's specifically good. And if they don't do a good job, it's par for the course and you still might enjoy the movie. I think a lot of brains get instinctively checked at the door for horror more than most other genres. And for that reason, I think it's maybe to the horror movie's advantage to not have mainstream recognizable actors. Steven Yeun kicked ass, by the way. Samara Weaving, I didn't know before this. I thought she was great. A lot of these other actors I might have seen in something else but didn't remember it until I looked it up on IMDb later.
She's in The Babysitter on Netflix, one of their original films. She's the babysitter.
Which I still need to see, and we should probably discuss when I do.
It's very like bright, and there's another movie that came out this year about Christmas. I watched it too.
Better watch out.
Yeah, I watched that one too, yeah.
She's in that?
With just babysitters.
Oh.
things that go terribly. But also, before we go to break, I just want to ask, what about when actors play against type? So cheap thrills for me. Ethan Embry is in that film, and David Koechner. So David Koechner is normally this very comedic persona, but in Cheap Thrills, he's pretty menacing. And then Ethan Embry is a different character than what you're used to, and they pull it off. So when they play against type, like Patrick Stewart in Green Room, I wonder if horror movies... listen, I love Patrick Wilson. I think the Conjuring films are great, but I always know it's like, hey, there's Patrick Wilson on the screen. But maybe if they play against type?
I think, you know, I mean, it just gives that actor the opportunity to demonstrate their range or capabilities. I think, I mean, when they succeed, I think it's awesome, right? It's great. Well, a lot of people weren't thrilled with the movie The Number 23, but I adored seeing Jim Carrey doing a dark, twisted role, because no matter what people thought about the writing or this, that, or the other, how the whole thing turned out, I want to very stalwartly defend the quality of his twisted, paranoid performance. And I loved seeing that. That was awesome. And his weird role in The Bad Batch.
Oh, yeah.
The recent cannibal movie release. Like this weird – and he was very quirky and kind of humorous. But again, it was just such a weird role. A lot of people didn't know it was him unless they looked it up or knew before they saw it. Like these are interesting things. So I think they create great opportunity. That's what I want to say. They create great opportunity in the film and for the actor. Doesn't always pan out, right? But it's just like putting no names in a horror movie that you bust your butt on to try and make outstanding. It's opportunity. When you put great actors in a horror movie, it creates expectation, and we're just hoping that you meet the bar. I'm super overgeneralizing, and I'm trying to make an analogy. So don't get – if people are screaming at their screen, listen to this podcast. Like, I'm not trying to pigeonhole this.
You know what's also weird? I'm a big fan of Korean horror films.
Yep.
And a lot of the actors I do know, but when I first started getting into Korean horror, I didn't know any of them. So they might have just as well been those characters.
Right. No. And that's how I sort of think of Steven Yeun as that, even though The Walking Dead is such a big thing. If you're one of the people who doesn't watch The Walking Dead and who never did, and then you watch this, like, did you know him?
Yeah.
Probably not, you know? So I think that he is almost one of those choices.
All right, we'll be back. See you in a little while. Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. Not Movies, Flicks, and Films.
Wait, now it sounds like you might be heckling somebody, Mark. Who are we poking at?
Yeah, on the Crash Palace, the Last Knock podcast, homeboy.
Billy Crash.
Billy Crash. He keeps calling us by the wrong name. So it's Movies, yeah, Flicks, Films. The other day he called us Cinema, Movie, Picture. The guy just can't get it right. But we appreciate him calling us out. So not calling us out, giving us props. So, I mean, hey, do it however.
He gives us all these like these very sweet shout outs and everything, and he always gets it wrong. And in the last episode where they were talking about, unfortunately, the horror icons that we lost in the last year, on their most recent episode, he got it wrong. He said, Movies, Flicks, and Film. I screwed it up and I'm reading it right now. And the other guy, Johnny Numb, is like, I knew you were going to do that. I knew it. You always do.
Now, the good thing is that if he just said, hey, thanks to Movies, Film, and Flicks, and thanks to this, like, he messed our name up, and that gave us more time.
Right. We got extra – and at the end, they always end up correcting it after you know, he skerfuffles it a few times.
That's right. So, I mean, hey, keep messing it up. That means we get more promo time.
And then we'll talk about you, and you get more airtime when we talk about you getting us more airtime.
So, guys, just if you're – want to listen to a great podcast, listen to Smash Palace, and it is called The Fast Door.
No, I thought it was Palace Crashed.
Yeah, Palace Crashed, The Big Knock.
The knocking plane crash.
The first knock.
Ooh, does that star Richard Gere?
Yes, it does. That does sound like a night. Richard Gere in First Knock.
The Last Crash. It's got Elise fighting demons to save people from a plane crash.
The Last Crash?
That's
that's a Steven Seagal movie.
Oh, sorry, Billy and Johnny.
What? No, in the 90s?
Oh, 90s. Okay, 90s Steven Seagal is bomb, but now he's bombastically Huge.
This is the last crash.
With the Steven last Seagal. Crash. Well, Crash Palace, thank you for your shout-outs.
All right, Smash Place. We appreciate the Smash Place podcast. You guys are pretty good.
And they have two names, which is extra confusing, because it's like the Last Knock podcast, but Crash Palace Productions.
Jeez Louise.
I know.
Knock it off, guys. Just figure out one, figure out one name and stick with it.
Okay.
All right, so we're going to talk about some Belko. That was a good rhyme, huh? The Belko experiment?
So when I first saw Belko, I jestingly called it Office Space meets Battle Royale, right? Yeah. And then when I watched it a second time, now that I'm getting the right movie, as we're discussing, I noticed some things, just some, whatever, writing trends, some plot points that really reminded me of another movie. Mark, do you want to guess?
I got three.
Three guesses. Okay.
Ricky and the Flash.
No. But it's a good guess.
All right. I got one. I got one. Kramer versus Kramer.
Also no. Hashtag office something.
The River Wild.
That might be the closest. We're just sticking with Meryl Streep here.
The Post.
Lots and lots of Meryl Streep.
Out of Africa.
The Mist. Ooh. Stephen King's The Mist. There were a lot of things that happened in this movie during the sociological breakdown that really stick with me and make me think of The Mist. And I'm going to bring it up in our discussion, but it seems out of left field, but I think I've got some good analogies for it.
All right. So
as we get into it, do you want to introduce Belko?
The Mist.
The Mist.
Okay. The Mist stars Thomas Jane. Thomas Jane was in The Punisher with John Travolta. John Travolta was with Nick Cage in Face Off, right?
And Nick Cage has been with everybody.
And then Nick Cage was with Holly Hunter in Raising Arizona. Holly okay. Hunter was with Ray Romano in The Big Sick.
Okay.
Ray Romano was with Gene Hackman in Welcome to Mooseport.
Okay.
Gene Hackman was with Keanu Reeves in The Replacements.
He was.
Keanu Reeves was with Anthony Hopkins in Bram Stoker's Dracula.
I feel like we're going the wrong direction now.
Anthony Hopkins was in The Wolfman with Emily Blunt. Emily Blunt okay. was in Charlie Wilson's War with Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks was in The Post with Meryl Streep.
Oh, he got it!
48 Degrees of Kevin Bacon.
No idea where you were going with that.
I had it earlier, but I was like, I'm going to keep going. This feels right.
You're a lunatic.
Oh, man. All right, so you want me to break down Belko experiment, John?
I'm sorry, I lost you for a second.
You want me to break down the Belko experiment?
Yeah. Give it a summary.
All right, so we first came across this movie. John, they actually reached out to you to watch this, did they not? The people?
Yeah, that's true. I'm not going to say a little PR firm, but a PR firm hired by Fox Home Entertainment reached out to me because the movie apparently didn't get the box office attention that they expected.
It made $11 million worldwide.
Right. And so they, and it's interesting what the person said to me, the PR person. She said, we were targeting the kinds of accounts. She didn't say horror. The kinds of accounts that seemed that they'd be sympathetic to this film. Not her exact words, by the way. I'm paraphrasing. And so they said, hey, we want to send you this movie and we're going to send you some paraphernalia. And if you happen to write a review about it, that's wonderful. And if it's a positive review, we'd specifically love it if you posted all about it. And we're going to send you some fun little things. They sent me Post-its and notepads that said the Belko experiment. They sent me pens. They sent me like a set of stationery that would last me my first month in a corporate environment. And so I took a couple pictures of it and shared it around. Maybe I'll share it with this post. But it was really nice of them. And I got the Blu-ray for free. Regardless of what I did with it. So that was very kind. I was very flattered. I guess, you know, we've made a decent name for ourselves over the years.
That's right.
You're what they call
to send me this stuff. You're what they call an influencer.
Oh, I'm an influencer.
That's right.
You know, there was a pretty mean, well, he started out nice, but there are some mean influencers in this movie.
Oh, yeah. So the Belko experiment takes place in Colombia, and 80 employees are locked inside a building. We're talking locked. Steel walls that you can't even, you know, you take a... What's the word? You take
a blowtorch
to, and it doesn't even make the metal hot. They're locked in. They get this thing, hey, some people need to die, or these people die. So basically what it is 80 people are locked in a building. There's a voice from outside, from inside telling them what to do. There's cameras everywhere. Everyone's being spied on. And it's basically you have to kill 2 people or 20 people die. You have to kill 10 people or 30 people die. And it's very reminiscent of what? Battle Royale. There's a lot of Kingsmen in there. There's Lord of the Flies. There's Cabin in the Woods. I mean,
there's the Mist.
Yeah, I don't want to like. I mean, it definitely still stands on its own. It was directed by Greg McLean, who did Wolf Creek, and he also did Rogue. And then
makes so much more sense about the meanness of this movie. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and how straightforward it is, because both those films are both very straightforward. Rogue is, I love Rogue, giant crocodile film, very straightforward. But the problem was it was written by James Gunn, who wrote Slither, Super, and these independent films called Guardians of the Galaxy. James Gunn, if you've only familiar with his films, Guardians of the Galaxy films, if you watch Super, if you watch Slither, they're nasty little things. I mean, they're good, and they walk a tightrope, and there's good dialogue, good characters, but they're nasty little things. I mean, they're mean. So this script actually came about, he had a dream, he woke up, wrote the script in 4 days, he got the green light to direct it, however, he didn't want to do it because he was going through a divorce and he didn't want to kill all these people in Colombia while he was going through a divorce, so it's been sitting on the shelves for a long time, and so because of his recent success, they're like, hey, we'll give you $5 million, but James Gunn was like, I get to do whatever I want. So they're like, okay, so he handpicked Greg McLean, he handpicked his cast. And they all went to Columbia, and the whole cast just got wasted every night while the director did storyboards because he was really stressed out about it because he's like, you know, I only have 30 to 35 days to shoot this film with a lot of gore and a lot of actors. But, yeah, that's Belko experiment. But, yeah, the movie is just basically 80 people murdering each other. And then there's some alphas that step up. There's some, you know, there's some people who want to kill. There's some people who don't want to kill. There's some people who get killed. A guy gets his head smashed with a hammer. It's mean.
A guy gets his head smashed with a hammer. A guy gets his head repeatedly smashed is actually the word I'm going to use with an axe. A guy gets his head smashed in with a heavy tape dispenser. There's a lot of head smashing in this. And that is mean. And by the way, that was kind of my response. I really enjoyed this movie, but it was mean. Like when I smiled at this, it's because I'm a sicko who loves brutal movies. But I realized that a lot of people are watching this and they're just like, whoa.
See, I hate brutality for brutality's sake. I'm going to go back to – there's a lot of other movies made that have been brutal, but I'm going to go back to like I Saw the Devil and Thirst and that Chaser, these Korean films, which are very brutal. By the end of it, you just need a nap. You need to cry. You need to go watch some Wipeout, which they canceled years ago. I don't know why I mentioned that. You need to go watch some
Seinfeld. Is Wipeout Super Extreme Elimination Challenge? Is that what you're talking about?
No, they did an American version of it where it was fun, but it's stupid and brainless. You need to just turn off. But the thing is, there's a lot of art behind these films. They're very well made. They're well acted. They take you into insanity, but it almost makes sense. They're like these beautiful artistic visions created by auteurs. So I think when there are films that are brutal, I'm going to go along for the ride because I think there's a madness behind the method. I think the brutality is just part of the film, which was meant to be. So I like Greg McLean a lot, but I would have loved it if James Gunn directed this film. And don't get me wrong, I watched this movie and it passed by just perfectly fine. But I would have loved to see James Gunn influence his work with characters, less straightforward style, and the violence, because he's capable of all three. That's what I would have loved. But, I mean, Greg McLean told a perfectly serviceable film.
So starting with kind of the intro where they're kind of introducing us very briefly to the characters, I really liked the way they did it. I thought they did a very nice job, at least opening with a little levity, much as Mayhem did. In fact, I think this opened with more levity then Mayhem, as we were introduced to John Gallagher's character, as we're introduced to the dynamic of that woman from Perfect Storm and the glasses fellow, and he's talking about he's giving personalities to her ant farm, and they're having this nice little exchange. I really liked the dynamic between the people. It was very warm. When I first saw this movie, it really shocked me the level of brutality after they sprinkled this happy fairy dust in the first kind of 4 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's only 4 minutes, but, you know, they were clearly waiting to pull the rug out from under me.
And there's a lot of very good actors. Mike Milch, if you listen to our podcast about 10 Cloverfield Lane and Hush, he's really good in it. Oh, John Gallagher Jr., his character, Mike Milch, but he's very good. He's from Hush and 10 Cloverfield Lane. You have Tony Goodwin, who's from Scandal. You have Sean Gunn, who's Kraglin and Rocket Raccoon, and he's also in Gilmore Girls. He's in this film. Michael Rooker, Dr. Kelso, is in this film. One of the kids from Silicon Valley. I mean, there's a lot of very – I'm amazed they got the cast. This movie only cost $5 million. So these actors must have signed something to where if this film made money, they made money.
Oh, John C. McGinley.
Yeah, John C. McGinley. Yep.
And Stand Against Evil.
Yep. I mean, very great cast. What, Dr. Kelso, right? The script.
Yeah, and it had he's not big, but the tall British guy, Owen Yeoman.
Yeah. Was he British or Australian?
Well, I believe he is British. The actor, I mean, gotcha. Is British.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of familiar for the budget they had. This is one of the biggest $5 million budget casts I've seen.
Yeah, I was really impressed with the movie. It didn't wow me, but I very much enjoyed it. Rewatching it was by no means a chore. I liked the dynamics, the sociological breakdown that happens in this film. So the first thing that happens is there's kind of an alarm, right? We know that things are a little off. They mentioned that a lot of people didn't show up today to work and that there were different guards than normal outside, different armed guards, because there are a lot of kidnappings in Colombia. And this company specializes in resourcing American employees to international companies. And this company is mostly Americans anyway, and not in America. It's in Colombia. So it was an interesting little overlay. And there's kind of this alarm. And we hear the announcement that you mentioned earlier, and it said that, you know, in 2 minutes, I think it was, if two people are not killed, then, I don't know, four people will die, right? Ish.
Yeah.
Something like that. And that sets the stage. And what happens immediately is a lot of people, Andy Gunn is our stoner comic relief kind of and conspiracy theorist, and he thinks it's all a joke. And then later he thinks that it's just hey, do you see the papers we signed when we agreed to work here, man? They can do anything we want. This is a social experiment. They're looking to see how we react. They're seeing how we act under pressure. And then later, he totally degenerated when body counts really went up, thinking, it's all in the water. They're poisoning us with the – like, I thought it was hilarious that in a movie with this big kind of conspiracy, he's going for what I think is the lesser conspiracy.
Yeah, some lady's like, there's going to be mildew.
Right, yeah. When he spills, he's dumping all the water tanks. So it's gonna do mildew. It makes me think of Archer when they're saying, "Do you want ants?"
Yeah.
Like I love those little tidbits. Andy Gunn was especially humorous in this, but so that was like his little trajectory, and all of our characters have their own trajectory, or at least their category of trajectory. Did you, before I keep going with my line of thought, does this make you think of anything specific that you liked or didn't like, kind of about the paths that the characters take when kind of the frag grenade of reactions goes off? Like, we have Tony Goldwyn.
Goodwin.
The CFO or the COO. And he's like, look, let's all remain calm. We don't know what this is yet. I'm going to get on making some phone calls and get back to everyone. Hey, Frank, I'm making up a name. Let's get some bottled water. Let's all stay calm. Have a glass of water. Let's sit down. I'm going to start looking into this and get back to you as soon as I can. Right? He starts out as the good, calm, under pressure, take charge guy that should be there. And he takes a big hard turn that wasn't unpredictable. And other people are panicking. And And some people are reacting like, what do we do? Should we just start killing each other? Like, I liked it. Didn't feel staged. I couldn't see things being staged. Instead, I just felt it and experienced it. I like that. I like the execution a lot in this.
Gotcha. I 100%, I didn't care about any of the characters.
Aww.
John Gallagher? He just looked hungover every day. I just think, which he was, and well, supposedly from what I heard from the directors, not from him. But I knew it was all going to go to hell in a handbasket. I knew some of these people were going to turn. I knew a lot of these people were fodder. I knew people were going to get murdered. I don't think they set up. I don't think I cared about any of the characters. I just, I didn't
gasp.
I mean, that doesn't mean, I think that's what this movie was though, right? Just to kind of bring some people in and bring a whole bunch of gore.
I think so. Yeah, they didn't do much to make us, to cue us to overly sympathize with any one person. I think I can see that.
And then you watch other James Gunn movies, Slither, Super Guardians of the Galaxy. You can pick many of the characters out just off the top of your head. Like they're very fully fleshed out. So I definitely think his style was missing from this.
Mm-hmm.
But also they only had 35 days of shoot, so that's not much time with that kind of cast.
So how did you feel about the people who kind of became the bad guys in this movie?
I knew it. I knew who was going to do it. Because they set up John C. McGinley early because he's being a jerk.
They made him a weird creeper.
You know, Tony Goodwin's like the alpha guy. You know, he's going to do that. You know, and all of his stooges around him are going to do that. So I knew exactly who was going to turn. And I don't even think I saw a preview for this movie. I really haven't. I don't think I saw – I haven't watched really any press on this film. So I don't know. I just knew who was – there's the underdogs. There's like kind of like Mayhem. You have the nine, the bosses, and then you have the people working their way up. And here this was more about the lower level people fighting the upper level folks.
Right. And the upper level baddies were more direct. They were more involved. They were proactive instead of defensive. Yeah. Yeah, they were proactive instead of reactive. So like Tony Goldwyn, who we find out is ex-Special Forces, not that it becomes a big deal in the movie, but like he's talking about like, you know, we shouldn't resort to this, or maybe we need to consider all options. Someone's like, oh, not all officer trained killers, dude. And then he kind of becomes the bad guy. And while I'll agree, like they didn't do a lot to make us sympathize with any of the characters, to make us particularly like any of them, but I still liked the flavor that was injected, because when he went bad, there was a scene, probably an hour in easily, where he was doing, the announcement was 30 people need to die. It was something like that in the next X number of hours. And he lines people up with his cadre of baddies, and he is going to do a summary execution like Pablo Escobar.
Yeah, like, well, people over 60, people without kids.
Right, right. He's just, he has his methods, and yeah, it's almost like the no women, no kids, but or no women, or no elderly and no people who have kids. So when he does it though, his face, and I really remember this, he was like wincing and angry at the same time. And it's like, he did not want to do this, but he followed through. And the next shot, he followed through. He asked him to turn on music. He said, he yells, turn up the, make it louder. He doesn't want to hear people begging for their lives. He winces. He turns his head just a little away, but he keeps his eye on the ball, shoots the next person in the head. He hates what he's doing, but he has totally convinced himself that he, in italics, air quotes, needs to do this for his family. He's given himself a purpose. And I don't know. I like that. But then at the same time, he seems tyrannical when the tall British guy, Owen Yeoman, questions his actions. And he just, without a pause, says, don't you ever undermine me again. And he said it like he'd kill him without a thought. So it's like, it's almost like he was nom-shocking to me.
Yeah.
The deeper he got.
I like what you said about Tony, his reaction to killing all those people, the way he did it. But I don't know on what planet people would like that scene.
I appreciate it. I don't know what it's not like I enjoy what happened.
Yeah.
And I thought it was interesting too, that the dynamic of the bads, there was Tony Goldwyn, the head bad, right? There were two guys who were no names before the dynamic was developed. And they're just like his complete lackeys that do whatever he says. The big bearded guy and some other guy. Michael Rooker, he struck me as the everyman who is just frightened and looking for leadership. And if you are a persuasive leader, he will just follow you. He won't listen to reason if reason is scary. He will listen to you if you are absolute in what you say will happen. If you follow me, you will live. And then he just became a zealot. And that this is one of the dynamics, by the way, followed by the summary execution, which reminded me so much of The Mist with Marcia Gay Harden in The Mist, when she kind of became this weird little cult leader in that grocery store. And she had people who were scared and doubters who then saw what she predicted happen, saw the bad things happen, and then they just followed her blindly. And when she picked someone to be sacrificed, the military guy who played the vampire in the American version of Human Being.
Yeah.
When she just called that he be sacrificed for speaking against her, the people were just like, yes, get him. Like they just followed her. To me, that was Michael Rooker was that mob mentality to Tony Goldwyn's leadership. Like he just followed it blindly and was the most enthusiastic. Wait, about
Michael Rooker? Michael Rooker got killed. Yeah. He got brained. Yeah. He got brained before any of the murder happened.
What am I thinking of? Who am I thinking of?
You're then? Thinking totally... of John C. McGinley.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. John C. McGinley.
Yeah, Michael Goodwin and then John C. McGinley.
That's right. Rooker died earlier.
Like, did I fall asleep during this
I'm
movie?
Sorry. Forget me. But yeah, so John C. McGinley. But he was also our sociopath in the beginning.
Yeah.
If you will, like the weird creeper sociopath. But again, the way he followed it, he didn't question anything. He just did.
Yeah. The Mist, though, builds to something. And it builds to something absolutely devastating. This movie kind of builds to a meh. So all that murder and torture and innocents getting killed just means so much less to me at the end of this one.
It depends on the other things that you choose to see. I saw the security guard in Belko to be, in a way, also that soldier who was sacrificed to Marcia Gay Harden.
Because I'm talking about the ending in the car.
Oh, I'm not talking. No, I'm not talking about that.
No, but
that.
It
sorry.
Builds.
I thought you meant that Belko doesn't build.
No, Mist builds to something really heartbreaking. Tragic. This movie builds to something that you and I talked for a half hour the other day about how many computer screens.
Right.
So, I don't know.
I mean, I felt like though they gave us like John Gallagher was the closest thing that I could find to a purely good character in this. So he was our goodness. I thought the security guard was kind of like the moral line because he was the first to take action and not just words to disagree with Tony Goldwyn. And when he died to Tony, he also physically resisted Tony Goldwyn first.
I think it's Goodwin.
Goodwin. Okay. Tony Goodwin. Sorry, Tony, if you're listening.
Tony's pissed. Tony is pissed off right now.
Tony, I invite you to be our guest. If you're listening, you can be our guest next time. Just email me. And Tony Goodwin.
It is Tony Goldwyn. I'm an idiot.
Well, I messed it up when I thought
right,
I messed it
all
up.
All right, Tony, I'm sorry if you want to come to the podcast.
Tony, you can be a co-host. Yeah. But the guard verbally resisted first, physically resisted first, and then was killed. And when he got killed, that's actually when the shit truly hit the fan. When the person who was trying to keep order with the thing he had the greatest power to do – keep the guns out of their hands. That's when things totally degenerated for the innocents.
I don't think anybody should have gotten guns in this scenario.
Well, so can we, that's an interesting thing to mention. So remember the guns were in a safe and the security guard had the only gun at first. And these other guns are in a safe that the guard has a key to. Right. And Tony's like, yo, we need the keys to that. We should make sure the guns are safe, so we should have the guns. And guard's like, no. Well, eventually they get the guns. When they get in the gun safe, Tony Goldwyn actually, the character, actually says, as he's pulling it out, it's like, this is like I'm paraphrasing, like a needlessly large number of guns. Yeah. He made a comment, and the ammo, like he made a comment that this is a lot of stuff. This is way more than we expected there to be. Why did they put this here?
If they were going to go mean, I think they should have kept all guns out of it. It should have just
I wasn't a fan of the guns. I'm going to agree. Even though I kind of like the summary execution scene, the way that they did it, I definitely agree with you. It would have been cooler, the desperation that's cultivated without them.
Well, if you're going to go mean, go mean. Like, really go mean. Don't just give us a scene where 20 random people are killed.
So I know you like John Gallagher. You didn't seem super impressed with him in this film. Like, what were your feelings about the character in this?
He's just the stock guy. Let's not do this. Let's think it out. Man. I mean, I like him as an actor.
I thought he did. I guess I agree. You're making a good point just when you say that thing.
He's that guy.
I thought he did a good job of it.
Oh yeah, he's always good. But he was just Basil Exposition from Austin Powers. Right. He's not a person. He's a movie character meant to side one part of an argument. Like, he's not a character. He's just a device that's against another thing.
I think that's fair. And I've come out and said, I agree that there's not a lot of specific sympathy built for anyone. Yeah, I see that. I feel that.
You just got to make your make your violence really violent, or just or make us care for the people who are being killed.
Even the victims, because I didn't really sympathize too much with any of the victims as they were dying.
No.
Or as they were being hunted, maybe is the better word. Did you?
No, I didn't care at all.
I feel like they did such a good job focusing on the brutality. And, I'm talking about Tony Goldwyn's face when he's doing the summary execution. But when people were begging for their lives, I hear him yelling over them to turn up the music. I'm focusing on him. This movie kept the spotlight on the aggressors, even when people were being summarily executed.
Yeah, right?
And I have a feeling it's deliberate.
And then they were playing that song. They were playing like a cover over the whole thing, which you were trying to be cute with.
Do you like that back in the opening credits, they were playing a Spanish version of I Will Survive?
Yeah, that was good. That was good. But just during the killing, like the music, when I picked, turned the music up, and I don't know. I think this movie cost $5 million and it worked really well. And I think it looks good, but I just wish James Gunn would have made this film. I think it would have been, and I wish I'm very happy that Greg McLean got a major movie. I think he's a very good, straightforward director. And if you watch Wolf Creek 2, that's one of the meanest.
Meaner than Wolf Creek 1?
Watch it. It's like him turned into T-800. Ooh. Basically, but it's mean. It's like
I haven't seen Wolf Creek 2.
And you know what's crazy? I hated Wolf Creek 2, but I still think about it. Belko Experiment, I just don't – I'm not going to think about
it. I do think about it, but I do get your points too.
I don't know.
Can I ask you – so did you watch this once or twice before our episode here?
Just once. I didn't want to give it time.
Okay. So now that you've seen it, is this a movie that you will probably never directly choose to watch again?
Yeah, I won't watch it again.
Like, you wouldn't pick this. Like, you wouldn't No. You wouldn't be flipping through the stations or see it on Netflix and watch it again.
Uh-uh.
So I would. I'm that guy. But I'd probably need to be cued, like, the next time a movie superficially following our office horror theme, if you will, comes out, I might watch this again. Yeah. Especially if we were going to discuss it. But I might watch this again kind of thematically. But I probably wouldn't – or if someone was in the house and they're like, oh, I love these actors and I never saw Belko, I might say like, oh, I have it. But I probably wouldn't just like pick it on a Sunday afternoon to throw on like I do hundreds of movies a year and watch by myself. I probably wouldn't do that, even though I really appreciated it. But it's not going to make me go feel good.
It won't be playing during – but see, the problem – this sounds weird, and maybe I'm being like one of those stupid Last Jedi fans that are like, it wasn't what I expected. I hate it. But
– we love The Last Jedi, by the way, people. Don't yell at your screens.
No, and if you are a Last Jedi fan who didn't – were expecting something different and you got angry, I get it too. You know, like that's your Star Wars. You grew up with it. I get both sides. But with it's a movie about mass murder, and I'm really nonplussed by it. I'm very meh towards it. I don't know. It's weird. It wasn't – I keep saying I don't know a lot about this film, but – movies like these should be affecting, and this one just never did it to me.
That's very fair. I think that I was affected because I have a love for brutal films. So I, it's not the same thing. You know what I mean? So I get it.
Man, there were some crazy reviews about this film. One lady went off on it. This one lady wrote, I'm not talking about you. This is one of the angriest reviews I've ever read in my life. She goes, when this movie finds its fans, it'll be among the instigators and internet bullies, the type of people who know very well why there isn't a White History Month, but like to ask the question anyway, while safely situated behind a keyboard.
Whoa! I mean, look, fine.
I'm not saying you. I'm not saying you.
No. That's totally – no. It doesn't matter if she means me or not. Well, she does mean me. She's implying me because I like the movie.
No, I feel like she's the one that's like the massive audience. Are you the audience of this film? You watched it and you appreciated it. They sent it to you and you appreciate that because of horror. You're not appreciating it because you're like, yeah, bro.
Oh, yeah. Overpopulation is a problem anyway. Shoot them.
Yeah. I mean, you just appreciate the horror aspects of it.
It's like, oh, yeah, let's see how they behave. Oh, they're killing each other. I don't know why I'm using what could be inferred as an accent from somewhere. I'm just trying to sound like an asshole. I don't know what I'm doing.
you just like sound like a really nice guy. Oh, man, this is great. I love all this murder.
You know, the person who's really calm who says that, that is the person with human organs in their freezer.
Yeah, there we go.
Wait, I'm sorry. If you're a listener and you feel that, please keep listening. I didn't mean it.
And if you do have human organs in your freezer, keep listening anyway. We're not.
I heard sweetbreads are delicious. Keep those organs.
We don't condone it.
But if you already have them, make a stew.
Just don't do any more. All right, so at the end, right? John Gallagher Jr. is the only one that walks out. He walks out. There's all these guys. Hey, this is an experiment. He kills all them. But at the very end, you cue back, and there's a guy watching 165 TV screens, correct?
Right. And the screen is actively panning out, so we don't know if it stops at a 11 by 15 rows and columns or if that's the max. But, yes, 165 different monitors of simultaneous endings in real time. Of these experiments.
All right, so
someone bursting out of a door, one's by a park, one looks like it's by a high school building. They're all in daylight, by the way, so if they're all over the world, there has to be daylight when these things are all finishing.
And so if 80 is the number, you want to keep that number constant, so that means there's 13,200 people.
It's a lot of poor souls
which means there's 165 buildings, which cost at least $10 million because of all the metal and fortifications.
It's a lot of money.
So you're having about 13,000 people dead. How are you going to hide that?
You know, I'm not trying to get into history or sound like I know anything about history, but when we talk about the most tragic days ever based on human lives lost, would that rank as the worst single day?
Yeah.
That's a lot. I mean, I don't know any – full disclosure, I know nothing – like I don't know anything about the worst days of any of the world wars or anything like that. But that strikes me as an awful lot of life lost. I mean, well, I guess bombs were dropped.
And you can't just be like 165 gas mains blew up.
I mean, maybe when bombs were dropped in war, like you know, nuclear bombs, maybe that does exceed that. I have no idea.
Yeah. How are they going to – who's this company?
That's a lot of – I mean, this company is like some future Umbrella Corp, like silly, stupid rich.
You said Thanos.
Right. We were discussing this the other day for a really long time on the phone. And, it was my suggestion that for someone to pull all this off and all the cover-up involved, it would not just take mega kajillions of dollars when all is said and done. All the cover-up, all the prep, all the salaries, all the payouts.
The contractors.
Paying like everything.
You could track where that metal got bought.
But I mean, you would legit need magic to cover all this up. Like I think you need a big purple chinned dude who has infinity stone knuckles on his gauntlet. That's what I think it takes to pull. I don't think Doctor Strange alone could do it. If you give Doctor Strange like a third of the money of the world, I don't think he could really pull off all the logistical problems. He's just one magical dude. Thanos, though. Maybe he's got all those stones that he's amassing. He's a bad guy. But, I mean, when you really think about all this happening at the same time and all the prep – like these people – some of these people were just working there that day, like their first day one of them was showing up. Other people were there for, I think, a couple years.
Yeah.
I mean, this took a long time to develop. And during the plot, remember at one point someone was even saying, like, what does this company even do when the shit hit the fan? What do we even do here? Like, do you know what we do? And someone, like, repeats, like, what? We outsource this, that, and the other. He says, yeah, but who's actually doing that? It was like they were all doing background things that weren't that.
Yeah.
And I have a feeling, by the way, that the implication was that all those people, maybe this is just my fun nonsense theory, but that all the people in all these Belko companies are recruiting people to be in the next Belko experiment, to work for the companies that don't yet exist to build the next Belko experiment. Well, let me rephrase. If all the different experiments happening at once, these 165 companies, if they were all doing the same thing, but maybe just this company is doing that.
Yeah.
Because they make the point of off American soil.
Oh, yeah. And they do. Oh,
so they're hiring the people that are going to these buildings. They hire.
That's what I think that they're doing. Or at least for the international ones, if there are any domestic ones. But again, like when you really. So I paused on that last scene that had all those screens. Mark and I talked, and it's like it really opens a ridiculous rabbit hole of theoretical conjecture about what's going on in this social experiment, which is what it was. This was a social experiment to weigh people's reactions. And Mark and I were talking about statistics and 80 people per sample size, or is the sample size different? And they're actually just relying on the question at the end where they ask John Gallagher one question. How do you feel in this moment? That's what he said. In this moment, do you feel A, relief, B, anger, C, fear? You know, like, and then he breaks free in the middle of it. But what if that's the only datum that matters? We don't know what they're studying. Like, this is just bonkersville.
It would have to be 80 people in each, because if you're in an office with only 10 people, you know each other better. So that death is going to be a lot worse because you're probably more familiar with each other. But when you have an office of 80, everyone doesn't really know each other. So,
but maybe their sole interest is whether or not the survivor is scared, relieved, or angry, regardless of their interactions that they had. They just went through an immense trauma. What if the real thing they're testing is just your response to all the trauma?
I think there'd be more trauma, though, if you were in a smaller workforce and knew the people better.
Some people go into shock just because they witnessed someone get shot who they didn't know.
Yeah, it's true.
I'm not making that as the rule to say, like, oh, you're wrong. It's just like, I'm just saying there's so many weird, like, this is, again, this is like the scientific variable machine. Like, it's.
Hey, we got three listener questions to knock out real quick. You want to do that?
Oh, my goodness. We should. It'll give us a moment to reflect.
There we go.
Cool. Our first listener question comes from Wolfman Josh, who is a co-host of the Horror Movie Podcast. By the way, I love it as our podcast community comes together and we're getting questions from their podcasters. Wolfman Josh asks, would Belko be better if the likable characters were forced to kill each other rather than it always being good versus evil? Or do you prefer the mayhem model where friendships of convenience happen to form? Interesting question.
Yeah, the likable characters were forced to kill each other.
So I'll just – do you want to start?
I mean, the way they separated these people in Belko with like this – the upper white dudes like running around like killing people, like it really took away a lot from it. And then you had the weaklings. I don't know, if misunderstandings happened, if something weird – if something set it off, if people who were familiar with each other, you would have cared more about the film. But the thing is, though, the mayhem model where friendships of convenience form, that friendship between the two of them is a lot different than the friendships, you know, the friendship of convenience in Belko. Because
were there friendships of convenience, or were they just people who were already friends?
Are you talking about in Belko? Because we don't know the backstory. So, I mean, people do bond. Like, I mean, people probably do go in their own groups.
Yeah, like the best pairing I think of is John Gallagher and the girl he was flirting with, but we know they have some kind of history. And I mean, but that's the most distinct one to me.
Friendships of convenience are good because you have two people and you get to know them, play off each other, so there's someone to care about. But I also think I like it better when likable characters are forced. I mean, you have these movies where two friends are forced to fight each other, where something happens, where, you know, I think that is, I don't know, I think that would be a lot more exciting than just.
Yeah, I guess this is the throwaway answer, but it's like it depends on the execution by the filmmakers on screen.
Yeah.
I mean, because you're talking about how in Belko, we happen to not really get involved with any of the characters sympathetically, but that's because they didn't give us the information, the exposition to do it. Had they done it, that simply would have been there, and it could have changed our dynamic, you know, weighing this. And if you give us a friendship of convenience that isn't properly developed and that alters as the story progresses, then that's kind of a fail. It's like I don't really have a favorite. I guess I don't have a favorite. I don't want to have a favorite because I liked that these movies were different in that respect.
All right, well, how about this? I just don't want good versus evil. I want some three-dimensionality in there. Put some gray in there.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Like, most of the people who were bad, pretty much everyone who was bad in Belko either gave us no inklings of specific good before, or, you know, we totally bought them going evil.
Yeah.
It's, whereas it was, with the exception of the evil boardroom on the top floor in Mayhem, there was a lot more ambiguity. There was just a lot of chaos and pandemonium happening on these office floors. Yeah.
Let's go to the second one.
I like that they're different. So our second question comes from the Beyond the Void podcast, and they ask, which main protagonist is the smarter protagonist to survive this situation and why? So I'm assuming they mean John Gallagher versus Steven Yeun.
Well, they both live, but I'm going with Derek because he takes the fight to people. I like him.
He does, but when you choose to go fight instead of calmly hide in your room, you increase the probability of dying.
Yeah, but he lived.
So regardless of that action, I feel like Steven Yeun had more opportunity to be smart, and by that I mean like strategic. He was very strategic, his decisions. Like, he had an ambition and he knew how to get it. And I feel like John Gallagher's character, because of the situation around them, by the way, is what I mean. John Gallagher's opportunity was more about being rational, which isn't, you know, I mean, one is more tactical. The other is trying to bring reason to the people
around you. I'm going with Derek and Green Room. There's a scene where they're talking about playing paintball and they got wiped out while never mind. But yeah, I'm going with Derek. I'm going on the attack. I'm doing
Steven
that.
Steven Yeun, I'm playing neutral.
Well, look at the people who hid. Like, I don't know. I'm going Derek all the way.
Derek all the way. All right. One last one. This last one comes from Billy Crash from the Last Knock podcast. Billy asks, do you think grand conspiracies and films such as the Belko experiment are ludicrous or do they enhance the terror?
Ludicrous.
Just ludicrous?
There's no terror because you and I have sit there. We talked about 165 screens and started breaking down data and how much metal costs.
That was well after we saw the movie.
Well, no, I was thinking about that because I asked you how many screens. Like I was like, because that always was on my mind. And when you said you were watching it again, I was like, hey, can you count the screens for me? Because I didn't have the movie on me.
Right.
So I don't know, the whole like experiment, like I just went, oh, brother. And then I just started thinking about Cabin in the Woods. Then I started thinking about other things. And then I'm like, is that all there is? And I was like, what's going to happen next? And there's all these like cameras. It just made me ask a lot of questions.
You know, you brought up a really good example for me to connect to. Because in the Cabin in the Woods, I actually loved the ludicrous conspiracy. But in no way did it inspire... Well, it wasn't really a terrifying movie, but it didn't enhance any fear at any time. It was just like, oh, what is this silly thing? Oh, it's doing this. It's like, so.
And then like in those Paranormal Activity movies, at first you just had, what was the demon's name?
Oh, in the third movie, they gave him the name Toby.
Toby. So then you got
the backbreaking jerk demon.
Then you have all these witch covens. And then like these witches are everywhere. How do they travel? Like, this is a big flock of witches.
Oh, no, I had a lot of logical problems with the witches. Yeah.
But when it was just Toby, you know what, I'm going to say it. That motherfucker was scary. All right? In that first film, that dude was scary.
Right. So, well, back before, he was Toby.
Yeah.
Back then, he was more of a Michael Myers. We had no idea why he was acting.
Michael Myers became part of a cult. Jason Voorhees, like, was part of a cult.
Right, part 9.
Yeah, I like it better when things are simple. I don't know, like, they tried to build to the backstory of the creatures from the descent. I don't know. I don't like grand conspiracies in films. And because then it just,
it makes, you know what else, when it's a grand conspiracy, they're just saying, hey, by the way, boom, I'm just telling you this is what made all of that happen.
Yep. Like, little conspiracies bother me. So when it's a grand conspiracy, like, it's just, I don't know. It's not terrifying. I think anything in horror that makes you ask questions, like, hey, how did Michael Myers drive there? How did Jason Voorhees teleport there? I think these scenes take away from the horror. So I think any grand conspiracy that could raise more questions, they're not good for the film, for a horror film. At least that's what I think.
That's fair. I'll agree that they're ludicrous. I'll agree they don't enhance the fear, the terror. I mean, I was entertained by them. I kind of it's almost kitschy to me. Well, in this movie, I should say, I was entertained by it. I thought it was laughable that they made Jason a deadite.
Yeah.
And Jason goes to hell. I mean, I laugh. I like that movie for its zaniness, to put it best. But that movie also had, and Part 8 even, had a lot of Freddy-isms because it was after New Line took over.
Yeah.
There were a lot of weird Freddy corollaries in my, I thought anyway, maybe someone thinks I'm full of it, it's hand waving almost. It's like, this is how we're changing things.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know. I'm just not, keep it simple. But that's a good question.
Billy, I'm really curious if you decide to write in, I'd like to know what examples you might have been thinking of when you brought up grand conspiracies that may have enhanced terror.
What about the one in The Arrival?
Oh, you mean like the global warming machines?
Yeah. See, I like that one.
Yeah, that was really funny. And also, but you know what? They revealed little bits about that. Actually, they kind of revealed it when there was still 20 or 30 minutes left, I think. You know, and then they just kept building, right? So we got little clues and we built, and it was a part of the plot device. You know, I don't know how to say it. It was one of the many plot devices progressing with the movie.
Yeah. So and that was handled right because they answer everything.
So maybe it's more the grand conspiracy that is dropped as a bomb at the end of a movie.
Yeah, no, yeah. And that's happened a lot too. And you're like, wait, what?
Yeah.
I don't know.
But I am curious about what Billy was thinking when he brought that, like if he happened to be thinking about anything specific when he asked that question.
Yeah. Oh, well, let's hear about it. Billy Smash.
Billy Smash from the Last Crash podcast. Crash Palace. That wraps up our listener question. You know, again, we had a wonderful response to listener questions this episode. I really appreciate that from the listeners.
Yeah, we had a lot. We had a surplus. So plugs?
Plugs, huh? Well, I mean, this is going to be really random, but I was listening to this horror movie night podcast recently, and I'm really just plugging them because I really appreciated what they did. And in their episode, they revealed to me something I thought was delightful, and that is that there is a movie in the world called Blood Fart Lake. And I mean, a feature length film with that title. And so I looked it up, and there's even a Terror at Blood Fart Lake. I mean, this is like a sophomoric joke, but these movies exist. And then I found out that there's a whole set of horrible, horrible, horrible movies that really exist. So I don't know. This is just my very obscure thank you to the Horror Movie Night podcast for bringing that to my attention. Honestly, my biggest thanks is for all of the people who provided our listener questions. There's Wolfman Josh from the Horror Movie Podcast. That's at Horror Movie Cast on Twitter. We had at Charlie B. Murphy from Twitter. He has his website, www.cbmurphy.net. There was Beyond the Void Podcast, who I'm actually just now discovering because of their question. They are at BTVcast. And, of course, at Crash Palace and at Johnny Numb, who co-host the Last Knock podcast and write for Crash Palace, and Johnny Numb writes for Loud Green Bird. These folks are all pretty supportive of us. I really appreciate them, even if they mess up our name all the time.
Yeah,
but you know what? I mean, really, we love answering your questions, and your listener questions a lot of the times can really enrich the narrative of our episodes. And You force us to think of questions that we might not have thought of on our own, or that make us think about something in a slightly different way. So, I mean, to all the people listening now, if you have listener questions, you can email me. I'm willing to take them. I'm johnshorrorcorner@gmail.com. We have two Twitter accounts where you can find us. Hopefully you're already following us. It's at Movies, Films, Flicks, and at MFF Horror Corner for John's Horror Corner. We have our Facebook page. And Mark, anything to say? And how can they find us to listen to us?
Yeah, just head over to Stitcher, head over to Blog Talk Radio, head over to Podbean, iTunes, just type in Movies, Films, and Flicks. Also, go to iTunes if you get a chance. Just please rate, review, and subscribe. We just need everything we can get, and we appreciate you listening.
Yeah, thanks a lot, guys.
All right, guys. Yeah, so for me, Mark, and John, thank you, guys. See you next week.